Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
A Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Hey everybody, it's Noons and Will. It is the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco Q&A edition this week. You bring the questions, we bring the answers. Hello, Will.
How you going?
I'm super. In fact, I'm Perth supered after a big weekend of watching the Wanneroo Supercars round. I'm feeling very supercar-y.
There's a few people that aren't feeling so super after that round, I feel.
There was a bit of controversy, bit of drama, bit of anger, bit of damage.
You love to see all that with the possible exception of the damage.
True. But there was plenty going on, plenty of animosity, plenty of antagonism. Getting to say a lot of A words in this podcast. But we've been building up a question bank in the last couple of weeks through our social media accounts. If you're a regular listener of the pod, you know that we do these Q&A episodes because we love to give you, the fans of motorsport, the opportunity to pick up some info that you might not get anywhere else. In fact, I don't know anybody else in Australian motorsport that does it to the level that we do it. So I'm not sure if we're really good or really silly to do this.
Well, you know, we're here now, so.
Let's do it. I've got a list. Let's bowl in. Troy Summerfield, he's a regular. Aside from people who don't contest the next season, who has the worst title defence, and that is in Australian touring cars and supercars, who's got the worst title defence on record? And I think you've got to really look at the results sheet to really judge this one, not the lick your finger and put it in the air test. But yeah, who springs to mind?
Well, the most recent one I can think of is probably James Courtney. Like he won the title for Dick Johnson Racing in 2010 and then moved to Holden Racing Team. And he won at the start of the year, but it kind of tailed off very rapidly after that.
He finished 10th in the points.
Which is probably higher than I would have remembered him doing so. If you'd asked me, I probably wouldn't have considered him finishing in the top 10 that year.
It was a pretty lackluster championship defence for JC, apart from that one win in Abu Dhabi when Jason Bright were fighting it out tight on fuel at the end. But, yeah, 10th in the points. Russell Ingall's got a – he comes up in contention when you look at the next season. He finished 8th in 2006. That was a big slide from where he'd been runner-up in 04, champion in 05, finally got that championship that he'd been hunting for so many years. And then he was never a championship contender again.
It was really the end of that Stone Brothers Racing golden era where Ambrose got two titles with a BA, then Ingall got his title, and then
Marcus left.
Then Marcus left, and then the rise of Triple Eight and a lot of,
ironically using Stone Brothers engines at the time. The other one that springs to mind is Peter Brock. And you might be a bit shocked to go, hang on a minute, what are you talking about? Well, 74, he wins the title for the Holden dealer team. 75, he ain't with the Holden dealer team. He's privateer for Gaun Hindhoff. And, of course, in those days, not everyone, even the stars, did all the rounds of the Touring Car Championship in that period. But he was driving a privateer car. He finished 7th in the 75 championship. But, of course, he won Bathurst. So, you know,
really
which would you rather? There has been drivers who didn't defend the title the next year, so we're not counting them in our worst title defence because you can't have a worst title defence if you don't actually defend the title.
Can't lose a race if you're not in it.
Exactly. Robbie Francovic in 87 because he'd been with Volvo the year before. Mm-hmm. Craig Lowndes in 97. He was off in Europe after winning in 96.
With Dr. Helmut Marko.
And Scott McLaughlin, of course, 2020 champion and was gone for 2021.
Johnny Brown, what more has the Giz got to do to match Jim Richards in the versatility stakes?
It's a good question.
It is a really good question.
It's interesting, but I can answer it with a pile. How long a list can I go?
Yeah, I know, right?
Multiple Targa Tasmania wins. Australian NASCAR title. I can't see Shane doing that anytime soon.
That's going to be hard for him to do.
Unless he self-funds the Calder Park Thunderdome to be reopened.
Look, someone has to. I don't think it's going to be Shane, though.
Nah, I've got a feeling not. he is the most applicable, and not just because he's a Kiwi, but of all the current supercars drivers, you know, New Zealand Grand Prix winner, open wheelers, Bathurst 12-hour race, he's, you know, he's going to be the Mercedes again this year.
Yeah.
Rallying, ARC, bit of a sniff that maybe he might have a crack at a world round in New Zealand.
Which is a parallel with Jim Richards' early career because he did very good, and it wasn't at world championship level purely because New Zealand there wasn't a world championship at that point, but the rally that eventually became Rally New Zealand, Jim was in a factory escort against Hannu Mikkola back in the day and did very, very well till he rolled the escort off the embankment.
I think Mr. Mikkola, the story goes, might have taken a young Jim aside at the end of one of those days and said, "What do you think you're doing, son? You need to slow down here. You can't make me look bad."
And this was after Jim had won a heap of stages in the repaired escort.
The slightly panel beaten version.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't think anyone could match Jim Richards' versatility. It's one thing to be versatile, to have a go at all these things. It's another thing to actually win in them all. But for sure, Shane's won in pretty much anything he's jumped into. You know, he's done some GT racing in Europe as well.
Spa 24-hour pole sitter.
There's not much he hasn't done.
Won the New Zealand Grand Prix in an open wheeler. That's another good one. But I guess we'll have to wait and see whether he ever turns up at the Australian Motor Car Championship in his road car and takes a class win like Jim did.
When did he do that?
1985, when he won everything.
Was it a BMW?
It was. It was a BMW 635, funnily enough.
In a Motor Car. I never knew
won
that.
His class, yeah.
Lucky someone's thinking of doing a Jim Richards book, huh?
Yeah, I know, right?
It's a big book.
Yeah. We'll wait till Shane gets on a bike and see what he can do as well, because apparently Richo's had a crack at like club level, like off-road motorcycle racing.
Didn't he tell me on the podcast a few years ago he went and did some drag racing at Calder on his bike?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And he also won like this celebrity, I don't know whether you'd call it a celebrity race, but it was a challenge race where Marlborough lined up some motorcycle races and some car races, and they did a race on like 250 proddy bikes at Surfers Paradise and then swapped into Nissan Pulsars. Jim won the bike portion of that, admittedly with a handicap start over a bunch of no-name guys, you know, like Greg Hansford, Kevin McGee, Mick Doohan, Michael Dowson.
What have they ever done?
Yeah. So.
And did he win the cars?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, it goes without saying, doesn't it? But I think Johnny makes a great point that he's the only bloke who's in the category cut from the cloth of the current breed. I mean, some of them are doing other racing here and there, but not to the level and the breadth that he's doing and the success as well. And, of course, don't forget he had the Trans Am thing that has not happened because he got COVID for Bathurst 6-hour, but he's also shown an interest in having a crack at that. So I think it's great that he's doing all this stuff, but
well, it sort of brought back that trend of drivers having a crack at everything that sort of went away for quite a long time.
Yeah, and it's sort of been a supercars thing where sometimes it was political, sometimes it was sponsorship driven, but I think the reality is it's pretty hard to stop anyone from driving something unless it's in your contract with your employer, i.e. your supercar team. If Jamie Whincup's happy for him, and it helps when there's common sponsorships, Red Bull with the rally car and Triple Eight running the Mercedes that he's going to drive at the 12-hour with Prince Jeffrey Ibrahim and Brock Feeney. So it's a cool comparison because he is the guy that when you think of who does he remind you of in terms of driving lots of stuff.
It's a logical conclusion to draw,
It's a natural connection. Marcus Bettino, this is a good question. I don't think we've ever been asked this. What exactly gets recorded in a supercar's logbook?
That's an extremely good question because we deal in a lot of old race car logbooks and they're quite a handy tool when it comes to tracing the history of a car.
But you can get tripped up with them.
Yeah, they're not definitive, but they're a really good data point. So I personally haven't seen one like from the past 5 or 6 years or so, but I've seen some from Car of the Future era, and that it's a pretty similar to what they've always had historically back through the early CAMS era. They log the chassis number of the car, build date and general specifications. There's photos of the car as it's to be presented, so in terms of its configuration and livery, and it also records appearances at race meetings and whether there are any eligibility issues and anything that needs to be rectified.
So when we say that it's not definitive, though, those which actually are Motorsport Australia logbooks, formerly CAMs, they're not a supercars logbook because all the cars are logged through Motorsport Australia. Supercars do have a record of all the current era cars, car of the future and so on. But for each round when the cars are scrutineered, basically all that's entered is the date, the track, as you said, any issues or items that they need to fix up for the following time or things that have been requested to be fixed, and a signature from the scrutineer. There's nothing written in the book to say this car was Tickford's number five Mustang rather than number six or whatever it might be. So it doesn't really delineate specifics, doesn't say who the driver was, doesn't say what the car number was, doesn't say how the car went that weekend. So if a team was to, and we've seen this in the past where we know from other ways that teams swapped cars or that they used a different car, but they might have just out of habit pulled out the logbook from the truck that's for the car that wasn't there that weekend.
Yes.
And that's got an entry in that logbook, but that car didn't race there that weekend. So that's why we say that they're not definitive. They're not 1,000,000% proof, but they are a really handy help. And it's a really interesting question because we do talk about them a lot in our stories online and on the podcast occasionally as well. So, Marcus, yeah, that's pretty much the element of what is included in the logbook. And when you said too, Will, about the photos, they usually have to update them when they, you know, if you updated your FG Falcon to an FGX, you had to put the new pictures in the, and quite often they're just stapled in the front over page of the little book. Yeah. They're only a tiny little book.
It's like a passport
size, basically. But for the values of cars, I mean, I've heard of some logbooks for race cars disappearing because they were mailed to the new owner or back to Motorsport Australia to be updated. And if they go missing in the mail, you don't get them back. And, and they're a piece that, yes, you can get a replacement logbook to run your car still, but you don't have the one that's got the original writing from the scrutineers on the original dates and because all that type of stuff.
Not only is that the physical book irreplaceable, that data doesn't really appear anywhere else in CAMS or Motorsport Australia records to that level.
No, no, exactly right, exactly right. So great question, Marcus. Thanks for sending it in.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Eddie Benny asks, any chance you could do a podcast interviewing Tony Cochran?
Been asked a fair bit for TC. Had a meeting... Had a time lined up with him July last year, but unfortunately here in Melbourne, we were locked down. My plan, I was going to go to Queensland for a week and record a bunch of podcasts with a bunch of people, including TC. Now, he's in and out of the country. I think he's out of the country at the moment, off with, or he's just been off out of the country because of this Supercross, Super X, was it Super, well, you know,
yes.
Motocross world thing that he's tied up in, that he's signed up Nathan Prendergast, the Supercars TV head, to come and do the broadcast stuff for. Busy guy, hard to nail down. I have reached out to him in recent times. He's up for doing it. It's just pretty hard to find a slot. And I think he's got a fair bit going on with the Gold Coast Suns and obviously now with this Supercross stuff as well. So I am intending to find a slot with him at some point soonish anyway. Elliot Beaton is next, Will. Interesting. He's watched the complete 92 Bathurst telecast. He couldn't help but notice, this is a real sleuth listener reader type question, couldn't help but notice that the Peter Jackson team had three garages, two with the usual numbers of 30 and 35, but there was a number 32 garage, which he never saw a 32 car during the race. It's not in the results. What's the story?
So that, of course, was the first year where the new 5-litre V8 touring cars were eligible to race at Bathurst as a precursor to the 93 season, and Glenn Seaton Racing had the only Ford Falcon there.
The only legal one.
The only legal one, yes. And in case that car wasn't ready or there were issues with that car, he also entered the 35 Sierra, which of course took to the track with Wayne Park, David Parsons, and also entered the team's other Sierra as a backup as number 32. Now, Dick Johnson Racing had also done this when they intended to go to Bathurst with their Falcon, which was subsequently ruled as not being a touring car. So they originally had 17 as a Falcon, 18 as a Sierra, and I believe 117 as a Sierra, as a backup.
Mm. The difference being too there, though, that the 32 car didn't physically appear.
No.
It wasn't actually there. It
had been sold at that point, by that point.
Yeah, it was entered, but it didn't actually end up getting used or physically appearing. As we've seen, some teams take a car up there, practice it, park it, or withdraw it and not run. But good spotting, Elliot. That's an interesting one from the quirky parts of pit lane history.
I do love a bit of garage sleuthing. Especially the order of the teams at Bathurst. It's, yeah. Anyway, I definitely don't have a spreadsheet on that. Justin Alden asks, just an observation from the Australian. We're back into garage sleuthing with this.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. Just an observation from the Australian Grand Prix that had me scratching my head. I noticed the pit booms in the supercars pit lane only had the car numbers rather than the usual team name or key sponsors on them. Would that be due to potential commercial conflicts with Formula One? I believe
it's commercial.
So.
Yeah. Not so much in way of conflict, but in the way that you'll notice if you're at the track or if you watch Formula One on TV at Albert Park, any time that event runs, when it's Formula One sessions, the supercars pit lane, of course, it's a separate pit lane, those garages are closed, the booms come in, or they maybe they're the only thing that stays out. Basically, Formula One want it to be that you couldn't spot that someone else is there. Mm. So there's no sponsor stickers on the booms as there would be at every other round, only the numbers, so the teams know, you know, when the driver's coming out pit lane, they can spot it to swing in. It's a commercial consideration. So it's Formula One's event. They're not deriving any income from directly from the sponsors of the teams and giving – basically, there's no free kicks with Formula One.
Yeah.
It's probably the easiest way to describe it, and it's a unique situation for that event and that event only.
And you'd have noticed on the podium for the races there as well, there wasn't the Foxtel-branded champagne. It was just a clean skin bottle.
Mm. Yeah, so it's very much supercars racing at the Grand Prix, not supercars holding – one of its own events at the Grand Prix. There's a very big distinction, particularly from a commercial level. And it must be said too that the commercial ability of supercar teams is better now than it was 15 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the teams couldn't have merchandise there like they do now. They didn't have the same form of some of that other stuff that goes around their racing program. They just didn't have it. They weren't allowed to have it there previously. But
well, you remember in the recent Charlie Schwerkholt podcast episode, the sit down chat, he talked about the big activation trailer that they built for DeWalt that was meant to be at the 2020 Australian Grand Prix. That is the sort of thing that definitely would not have happened in the past at that event.
Yeah, totally, totally right. And so, Justin, that's exactly what it's about. It's all about commercials because at the end of the day, that's what Formula One's all about too.
Russell Newell asks, there was talk of an open Holden race car track session at the Bathurst International prior to its cancellation due to COVID-19. Is this likely to go ahead?
From what I can pick up, I haven't asked ARG this directly, but I think that's dead, which was going to be a farewell Holden, basically a super sprint event at the Bathurst International where any Holden could run as long as it was scrutineered and logbooked and cleared to go.
Which would have been cool with the sort of things that would have come out, were meant to be coming out.
There were
some
Group A Commodores that had already entered, some ex-supercars. That was the whole purpose of GRM building that other Monaro, apart from obviously selling it and making a quid. But that's where it was going to make its debut. That was the plan. But, of course, COVID completely stuffed all of that up.
Yeah.
And I think they kind of had the feeling of trying to do that Holden thing again. And of course, last year the International was rolled into the 1000. So it's a case of track time, but I don't think it's on their radar for this year. And it's kind of got to the point where, they had Shannon's actually on board as a sponsor that was all good to go. But I think it's probably one of those things where they might be too short of track time anyway now, given the categories that they've got that they'll have running at Bathurst in November for their event. There might not be room even if you did want to run it. So,
well, as we saw from last year's Bathurst 1000 combined event, that was really packed in terms of the schedule. I don't know where anything like that would have fit a six-day schedule.
Yeah, probably day 7, 8, and 9. Yeah. I reckon you could have spent a few days wandering around the museum there, adding on a couple of days to the event tally as well, which, by the way, the National Motor Racing Museum. It is open 6 days a week, every day except Tuesday. It's going to be our host location, Will, for our Friday night V8 Sleuth Open night at this year's Bathurst 12 Hour, which we're going to host. Neil Crompton is our special guest for that. If you don't have your tickets, get on it now. Eventbrite is where we're selling the tickets via. Or if you do a search on our website, you'll find your way there. Or Google it, you'll get to there either way. In fact, you'll probably drop the show notes with a link in
Indeed,
there.
Indeed, I will.
If you're a good man, you'll do that for the listeners who can just quickly click through their phones to get it there. But, National Motor Racing Museum, the place to go, just not on a Tuesday.
Not on a Tuesday.
Well, you can go, you just can't get in.
You can look at the new Winners Walk. Endurance Race Winners Walk out the front in the shadow of the Peter Brock statue.
Which they unveiled at the 6 Hour recently. So keen to get up there and have a little bit of a look at that. Ian Evans, good question this one. What makes up a driver's remuneration package, i.e. are they paid from the team, sponsorship deals? Have you guys got some insight to drivers who get paid big dollars through to drivers who have to pay to get a drive?
It's sort of a combination. Drivers can either be paid by the team, of course, or they can also have the opportunity to have their own personal sponsorship deals. We see guys like Mark Winterbottom, who I think had Brute and Munro as longtime personal sponsors. Will Davison famously has Doric as has had a personal sponsorship.
Imar,
that contribute to a total earning for them.
And sometimes it connects, it's a direct sponsorship deal with the driver, and the driver derives it because they're selling their helmet, which is theirs. Different teams have different plays. Mm. Obviously, you mentioned Will. So those sponsors are on the car. They've become a team sponsor, but kind of through Will because they've had an association with him. Mm. So there's no real formula to this, really, is there? There's some drivers who are the stars of the sport who get paid. They get paid by their team to drive. They get paid handsomely well. They have personal sponsorship deals. Basically, if you're wondering who they are, look at their helmet. And if it's not a sponsor that's on their car, it's pretty much their personal backer.
Like Woodstock Bourbon on Chas Mostert's helmet.
Good example. Great example. So, you know, he goes and does promotions for them, events for them, as long as it's not a thing that clashes with a team sponsor or anything like that. So that's a unique thing. Then you've got drivers who are paying to drive. They are bringing a budget to a team and the team is putting them in the car because they are bringing the budget. Now, sometimes that's a case of private money. You won't really spot any stickers on the car that are theirs, but sometimes what it allows a team to do, if a driver brings a budget of, you know, a handsome budget, $750,000, they can afford to then go and sell a cheaper sponsorship of a couple of hundred or whatever it might
be.
To top it up and make it a budget to be able to run. So there's a range of different situations and scenarios of how it all comes to be. And some drivers over the journey who, and it's changed so much over the last, probably since the GFC, I reckon.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of drivers who just didn't, they stomped their feet and said, no, I've got to be paid, but didn't want to go out and hunt the money. Whereas I think one of the great examples has been Jason Barguana. For a long time there, he went and found his own deals and took the budget and bolted it together and went to the team with it. And this is what a lot of guys have done over the journey, not just Barg's the only one. Mm. All right, I can have that seat. It's going to cost this much. If it costs X, I'm going to go and raise X plus 20%, give myself the 20% as a salary. There's the money to run the car. I've got to drive them away and going. So that's another scenario of how it can play out to be. But, you know, in a field of 25 full-time supercars drivers now, I haven't sat down and looked at the full list and analysed it all, but we're probably at the smallest point of full-time direct paid drivers probably in a while, I reckon. A third of the field? Bit over the third.
I reckon that's probably a sensible
and number. Then you've got some other drivers bringing. And sometimes drivers who are race-winning drivers do bring some money because if there's a bit of a space on a car, and it happens with co-drivers too, you'll notice some stickers that pop up on some cars in the mid to back of the field teams that are only there for Bathurst or a round or two around it because that's the co-driver who is getting paid perhaps nothing or a very small amount of money. But has been given contra, i.e. space on the car. So that's how they can make a buck or pay for their drive.
Yes.
Rather than, hey, here's an invoice, pay to come and co-drive. So from all of that, Ian, there's a whole pile of ways that the commercial pie can be cut. But if you're one of the top dogs, if you're winning races, winning championships, you drive for 888, you drive for Walkinshaws, you drive for Tickford, DJR, you know, if you're up the front, you're up the front for a reason and you get paid to be at the front.
Correct. Matt Bottrell asks, last Q&A you discussed the super license rules and how drivers remain eligible by having to earn points by doing so many races in a year. With Craig Lowndes doing Carrera Cup, Garth Tander doing Toyota 86 and other drivers doing similar, how does Jamie Wincup retain his super license for the Bathurst 1000 if he isn't doing any forms of racing this year?
Well, drivers don't remain eligible by doing so many races. They earn points to their super license by finishing in a certain bracket of the championship or series points in a bunch of different championships. And there's a table that Motorsport Australia give points for and all those things. But for that, it's a great point. It's a great question. Wincup is not racing this year. You know, Lowndes is doing minimal racing. Garth Tander's in the tally team now and done small amounts in the last few years. Those guys get special dispensation. They get a dispensation. They have to apply for it, I believe. But given their resume, given what they've done, given the level of performance that they're at, there's no doubt that they qualify to drive at the biggest event of the year in the best and biggest supercar category in the land. So,
well, the other thing is, as part of the super license criteria, you have to have, one of the things you can satisfy is having competed in a minimum of 3 rounds of the championship within the last 5 years. So even,
well, there you go, you take the box, yeah, don't you, as well.
So even with the Enduro Cup pairing down to just the Bathurst 1000, you can do every Bathurst for the past 5 years and still and qualify still for a super license.
Yeah, yeah, but if you don't meet that, then you can get a dispensation too.
Yes.
To get you through. So, yep, don't have to worry about these guys getting bone from Bathurst because they haven't done much racing of late.
I can just see Jamie writing out his dispensation form, his application.
Yeah, signed. To whom it may concern, from the team principal.
Yeah, just rips out the Hall of Fame page out of the media guide and go, find this supporting evidence.
Takes a photo of Ian ScoMo on the grid with his trophy from last year. Scott Nissen asks about a Ford, not a Nissan. What happened to the Ford supercar seized by the police in New South Wales as the proceeds of crime? I think it might have been a Briggs Motorsport chassis.
Was indeed a Briggs Motorsport chassis. It was dressed in later 888 colours, but it never actually raced as a Craig Lowndes 888 BA Falcon. It was indeed seized by police in Dubbo and was sold off as part of their proceeds of crime. I believe it was part of an auction last year that we reported on at the time.
We did. Yep. It was a Briggs car, but it was one of the first two that 888 acquired when they bought the team. So it's one of the two cars that they debuted at Sandown in September 2003 with. It was sold in the aftermath of that auction. It's gone to a private collector and it's going to be restored by one of the former 888 mechanics back to, I would say, I presume, 03 spec of how it ran when it first was with 888.
Which is cool because there's a lot of 888 cars out there, but none representative of that very first race weekend.
Yeah, and you know that livery was quite unique in 03. 04, 05, 06 all started to be a bit similar with the better cars, but 03 is a clear standout as being totally unique to the rest of those couple of years I mentioned.
Mark Scott asks, is there a chance the Nations Cup series will ever be released on DVD, especially the 2003 and 2004 seasons?
Good question.
Do you reckon he likes the Holden Monaro 427C?
I'm thinking there's a vibe there that he might be a little disappointed, though, because the old Monaro didn't win too many Nations Cup races in that time. Nathan Priddy did a bit in 04, but in 03, didn't win piles of them, but Brock won. I remember Gold Coast when Stokel and Priddy took one another out down at the ANA corner at the hotel there. Yeah, yep. Straight on into the wall at the first lap. There's a chance, Mark. I think the master tapes of most of those events are around. They were made by AVE for Procar with Procar back in the day. They aired on Channel 7 in 03 and Channel 9 in 04. Daryl Eastlake was commentating some of that Procar stuff in 04. So there's a chance. Is it high on the priority list? Not at the moment, but, yeah, it's around. We're aware of it. I think the bigger question probably is what's the future of DVDs? I mean, we're still working on them with Chevron Marketing Service. We're still pumping them out. There's still a bit of motor racing for us to release that we haven't released. But obviously that side of things is drifting away in the world. Streaming's a thing. We get asked regularly, why can't you put this stuff on streaming? Because Channel 7 won't, well, not specifically Nations Cup, but a lot of the other stuff. they have a streaming platform, so they're not going to just hand out their motor racing to someone else to go and make a streaming platform out of. So,
and then the other issue is if you're going to put it on someone else's streaming platform, there's so many out there. Everyone and their auntie's into it now. So
that's right. But to answer the question, Mark, there's a chance. And given that we're nearly 20 years on from those events, I think it's kind of going to hit that point of, I remember that. If we'd released that 10 years ago, probably wouldn't have resonated as well.
Yeah.
But now, you know, there's a bit of Brock, there's a bit of Jim Richards wasn't in Nations Cup by that point, but I did one round in Adelaide to start 03. But, you know, John Bow, Greg Crick, Vipers, Ferrari, Stokes, cool Lambo, cars. The Monaros. Yeah, there's a fair bit that would make people go, oh, yeah, I remember that. So,
and the racing was pretty decent.
Yeah, and the great thing was it was post-produced, not really hacked down from my memory, but definitely some cool cars and some faces and names that people have probably forgotten about. Remember Alan Simonson racing that 550 Maranello Ferrari,
the green Cooper's livery?
You know, that is one of the best sounding cars I've ever heard in my life.
Mm.
And that ran briefly in 04. And of course, Procar collapsed a couple of rounds into that year, and then they cobbled it together to keep the category going, and it ended up finishing at the end of 04 at Malala. So, I'd like to, but not quite at the moment, Mark, but one day maybe.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online, thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
Jeff Bishop asks, love these Q&A pods. Thank you, Jeff.
It's one way to guarantee your question getting asked, really is.
So, random with the subjects, I may have asked this before regarding the Thunderdome, but is there any evidence of Bob Jayne himself turning laps in either a NASCAR or an OSCAR?
Good question.
I don't know. I can't think of
it. I've never seen pictures, photos, video of Bob doing a lap at the Dome in anything.
Surely he must have.
Surely he must have driven in a road car around there. But in a race car?
I don't know.
If there's anyone out there who maybe worked at Calder Park in the late 80s, 90s, there's a few people that I know I could probably ask this to. But if anyone out there may have seen something, heard something over the journey or was there or knew someone who knows, drop us a line via our website. We'd like to know. And if we pick up enough intel, we can share the answer with you.
Because a lot of famous drivers had a crack in a NASCAR in that early or mid 87 period when the track had just been opened and they were doing tire testing. Richard Petty, Bobby Hillen came out, Alan Jones. Mm-hmm. As John Bauer told us on his very first visit to the VX Sleuth podcast, he actually christened the Thunderdome
with a crash.
He had a tire go down, and Bob wasn't too happy with that. But a lot of different drivers had a crack at a NASCAR in that time period, so I'd be amazed if Bob didn't have a go in his own car at his own circuit, having loved NASCAR for as long as he did.
You'd reckon, given that they built some of their own cars with John Shepard, that one of them somehow he would have.
Surely.
Just even at quarter race speed, just putted around his track. Like, for all the money that he invested and the big thinking and the effort to make that track and the whole, that form of racing happen, to not just pop yourself in for a little burn around would have been a real waste. Surely he found a way to do this. Surely. Anyway, we need some proof. We need someone drop us a line.
Someone surely took a photo if it happened.
You'd think. I mean, well before the days of camera phones to quickly go bang with a video or a – but you never know.
We've seen photos of other things.
Yeah, that's true.
We'd never have believed.
Yeah, you never know. So if you know, drop us a line. You know how to get in touch with the sleuthers. Kieran Andrew, how many uncompleted V8 supercar chassis have been built across all of the different teams?
I like this because there aren't too many cars that that were not built to completion, or even if they were, didn't turn up at a race meeting and take part somewhere.
Yeah.
So the obvious ones that come to mind, Lucas Dumbrell Motorsport built up their own Car of the Future chassis. Well,
they had Jimmy White put that together, Jimmy, who does the Erebus cars.
Jimmy's Fab Shop.
Mount Gambier, South Australia. They were going to build their own, have their own Car of the Future chassis, but that never came through to, it was built, but I think he's ended up we touched base with them a year or two about this, and I think they'd robbed some bits out of it for some other chassis. So that's one of the car of the futures that has a V8 supercar chassis number that's never actually become a V8 supercar. One of the other ones that springs to mind, because it's popped up recently, Paul Morris Motorsport had a VE Commodore supercar that they never finished, and the dudes had it there for a very long time on the Gold Coast. And I'm pretty sure that's now the car that Derek Hocking's running around in the Kumo Classic Series that ran as part of the AMRS at Sydney Motorsport Park earlier in the year. He had some problems with that car, but that's the car that's called Lakeside. Remember how they named all their cars?
Alphabetical so sequence, L, yeah.
That one that they were up to, Kawicki, then it was Lakeside, and then the next two were Mick and Nuvolari. That were the Triple Eight cars. Yeah, that's right, that Russell Ingall and Greg Murphy drove. So that's another one that springs to mind that never's made it to V8 supercar status. There's another white Commodore kicking around that the Wilmingtons have got as well, isn't there?
Yeah, that was originally going to be a team Team Dynamic built chassis that was never built up into a finished completed race car, and there was a couple of those over the years once that team got out of supercars. There's one in New Zealand that was built up into almost like a
GT sports sedan.
Yeah.
Nick Chester, I think, is the guy that's had it there. I remember seeing a race in New Zealand. It was black and like a aqua green
colored. Good looking car.
Yeah, yeah. It's externally not, doesn't look like a supercar, but the chassis underneath is a Team Dynamic Commodore.
That car is actually TD004, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. I'm not sure if the Wilmington car, so it's the car that Gary Wilmington's got that. I think young Braden's been having a punt around in here and there up in New South Wales on occasion. It was a dynamic car that never was completed. I think it's got an LS3 engine in it. It's not a supercar engine, but that's another one that did make it. The other one that springs to mind, Dencar built a VS Commodore chassis that was going to be, well, I think it was intended for the Holden Racing Team, and it explains why their cars jumped from chassis HRT 35 to 37. This was the VS that was going to be in the middle. I think it might have gone through the Romano hands at some point, or maybe been built for them at some point. But Richard Mork ended up with that car and putting the mechanicals from his crashed Phillip Island, from the gearbox Gary Quartley car into that chassis, and ran it in a bunch of non-supercar categories over the journey. That car is still around with a private owner, but it's not a... You know, it's not a V8 supercar. It wasn't built to completion in the period that the chassis was built. So, yeah, there's a few other ones that were built to completion but never raced. That Les Small Falcon.
The EB Falcon.
EB, yeah, that was one of those in 94.
There's that Dencar Group A car that was built up and is in all intents and purposes a race car but was never built for the purposes of going touring car racing.
Andrew Event's car, which that chassis ended up being updated to the later body kits, but is being used to, I think we did a story about this on our website, was it last year, year before?
Yeah.
So that the stolen Gibson Commodore in the UK that went bye-byes, the bits that were in that car, it was in a truck being transported to be painted, I think, from
something
memory.
Something like that,
and the truck was stolen, the chassis disappeared in the UK, but all the parts remained. So those parts are going to be married up with this body, and it's going to be creating, in essence, as close as you can get to a replica of that Mark Scaife Winfield Commodore that went bye-byes.
Yes. Tony Ryan asks, how many times have duplicate numbers been used in the same weekend? I see Sergio Perez used 11 at the Australian Grand Prix, which is, of course, Anton Di Pasquale's race number. And he recalls number 21 and 021 running at the same time years back in the hands of Brad Jones Racing and Team Kiwi Racing, respectively.
Well, it's an interesting one. So they only put 11 on the Perez car, which was the spare Red Bull car that Jamie Whincup was driving in the speed comparison because that's his Formula One number. So, yeah.
And they forgot the rear window, which still had 88 on it.
Yeah, right. Didn't quite nail it. So, yeah, he wasn't a competing factor that weekend, but I understand what Tony's saying. One of the ones that sprung to mind was when Peter Brock returned for Bathurst in 2002 and then 05, but there was obviously a 5, which was Glenn Seaton, and then that became Ford Performance Racing's car after he sold the team. So there were a couple of those events where there was 05 and 5. The one he mentioned of 21 and 02 one's the other one that regularly sprang to mind. But, you know, we had 88 and 888 and we had, you know, 8 as well. And
I can't recall many instances of 01, 5 and 15.
No. And remember that for a long, long time there was one number pool for V8 supercars, whether you're in the main championship or in the development series. That's why when Konica series started, there was all these cars with 70s, 80s and 90s numbers on them. Mm. Like Paul Dunbrell was 80 and Owen Kelly was 96 at John Faulkner's team and Ryan McLeod was. And it's because they couldn't use the numbers of the main cars. It was one big pool of numbers. But that changed, was that about six years ago?
15,
yeah, somewhere around there. Where there's separate number pools now. Mm. So you do get regular weekends where there's someone in Super 2 and main championship running the same number, but obviously.
Was it 2015 where Mark Winterbottom won the main game title with number 5 and Cam Waters won the Super 2 title with the number 5?
Yep. With V8 Sleuth backing on that NZ Falcon. It's an interesting one, but it's one of those ones where a zero makes it a different number, doesn't it? So
it sure does. Mm. They are different numbers. Mm. Kenny Martin asks, Bathurst 1000/500, what chassis has completed the most race laps and what does this equate to in kilometres? Be interesting to know the mileage on some chassis that have been passed to other teams or privateers throughout the years.
Well, this is a very long you could go very wild and out there with this question, but I thought we'd just hone in on supercar era stuff. Because that's what's in our database. That's what we've got really accurate data on.
Yes.
There's probably been a couple of Corollas over the journey that have done a lot of Bathursts.
Mm.
In terms of how many laps they've done, though, that would be another question and query, maybe one for another time.
Yeah. We'll note that one down.
We'll note it down to come back to you on this one, Kenny. But from a supercar perspective, it's actually a car that's going to be on the grid this year. The Tim Slade Cool Drive Mustang, which started its life as a Tickford, Pro Drive, FGX Falcon. It's done 6 Bathurst 1000s. It's completed 933 of a possible 966 laps. That's a pretty good tally.
Yeah,
It's 14,451 kilometres, by the way. And this is the car that has done every Bathurst. It's finished every one except the first one. In 2016 with Mark Winterbottom and Dean Canto, remember that
Frosty had a brake failure.
The brake failure at the chase. Yeah, correct. In 17, it was the Water Stanaway Monster Falcon, which won Sandown and
led a lot of a big chunk of the 2017 race, and then was the first, then provided the first instance of the trilogy of Mostert Waters tangles at Bathurst.
Turn one, on the way up Mountain Straight. 2018, this was the Milwaukee Davison Falcon from 23 Red, and again in 19, albeit as a Mustang. Courtney Feeney in 2020, and then Slade Blanchard last year as well. So, you know, it's done a lot of miles and it's basically nearly completed every Bathurst that it started, which is a fair effort. So that's the chassis that's PRA 1520 for those who are wondering. Falcon FGX for a few years, then a Mustang and still a Mustang with Sladey and Tim Blanchard for Bathurst this year.
Yeah, a couple of top 10 finishes off the tail end there as well.
Yeah.
The next closest to that is a car that also did 6 Bathurst 1000s. It's HRT 042 that did 865 laps.
Yeah, which was Craig Lowndes' 99 runner-up car that Scafie won the championship with the following year, but he didn't drive it at Bathurst. It spent some time with Kmart and Supercheap after that, PWR, so it had a few opportunities over the journey. FPR 1217, so that's Frosty's championship-winning car that you mentioned before.
Mm.
805 laps, it finished every Bathurst it started on the lead lap.
That's amazing.
Five times 161 is 805.
For a driver to execute that over 5 years is incredibly difficult, but the odds of a car doing that over 5 years through different models as well is very impressive.
It's pretty cool. That's a pretty cool one. Yeah. So there you go. That's a little insight, Kenny, into some of the cars that have done a lot of Ks. Of course, lots of the components have been changed along the journey with some of those cars and how many bits were in them the first Bathurst that they did versus the last. Yeah, not so many, but the chassis is the chassis. It's the same car.
Exactly. Last question from Tyson Arden. Now, I'm not going to read this exactly as it's intended because, as you might have noticed, my voice isn't at its peak.
All right, don't blow it up, but give it a crack. Yeah.
This is in all caps. Have you seen the remote control? I've looked all over the house.
Well, I have the same issue sometimes, and it's usually down the side of the couch.
Yeah, it's as they say, Tyson, it's always in the last place you look.
Yeah, and my dog likes to pick up things and carry them away but has not got into picking up the remote and wandering off with it yet. So, Usually I know it's not the dog, but could be the dog. You never know.
You just need to train it to change the channel.
That's exactly what you need. But sorry, Tyson, we can't help you with that one. Appreciate that you thought that we could. I don't know where your remote is, but I'm sure it'll turn up when you're not looking for it.
Best of luck.
Yeah, good luck. Great to have you listening, though. thanks for sitting through that one. A little bit of comedic relief to finish our Q&A episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast. Would you believe, Will, that this is episode 198?
I know, right? We're really getting up there.
So this week we have Repco Supercars Weekly coming up later. In fact, that's going to be on Friday. There's a special reason why we will reveal why on Friday. And then next week, number 200.
Yeah.
Woo!
The double century.
What are we doing for it? Are we having a party? Are we doing something special? Are we
getting Matthew Hayden in to raise a bat?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
Raise three bats. Why not? Let's just go nuts, go wild. So don't forget to Tuesday, Castro Motorsport News podcast with the boys, AVL and Steph, smashing it. Award winning, we have to say. They've told us that we have to say that every week that we talk about the podcast. Contractually obliged. It's contractual obligation as part of what we do. And, of course, last weekend we saw 600 wins for Holden with Shane Van Gisbergen winning at Wanneroo on the Saturday night. There's some cool stuff that's coming out now that you can pre-order too. Jump on our website, jump on our online store. A limited edition 600 wins Commodore, which has got a cool celebration livery that it's got a bit of a throwback to the original Monaro race car design that was on the posters at the time that Peter Hughes designed, who's designed this model car. So black, white and red looks cool. Have a look at our website. And there's a beautiful 600 wins collector's print that highlights and documents all the winning cars and the winning drivers from the 600. So jump on the website, don't miss out, and have a look.
It actually is cool to see that livery physically on a Commodore-style race car now, because it was always looking really good on paper.
It's going to be on a model. So jump in, pre-order it now so you don't miss out. You can do it through our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. That's us done. I hope we've answered as many of the questions as we can. We try our best. I know we get lots of them and some people get a bit shirty that we don't answer their question. We're doing our best to get through them. I do a column sometimes on the website to answer a few more, so keep an eye on v8sleuth.com.au for more of those. In the meantime, though, thanks so much for listening to the pod. We really appreciate all of your support. It's really great. If you're at the Bathurst 12 Hour or if you're at Winton Supercars, look forward to saying hello to as many people who are going to be there as possible. We'll be back with another episode number 200 next Wednesday. Chat to you then.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your Rego, select your state, and within seconds, you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.